Well, let me welcome everyone to the European Institute's lecture on capitalism and welfare. What model for Europe? I can't think of anyone more qualified to speak on that subject than our guest this evening, Carlo Di Benedetti, a major figure in the Italian business industrialist society, a principal investor in Olivetti, and indeed chairman of Olivetti until 1996. He's also executive chairman of, and here, please forgive me, sir, my accent on these things is not good, CIR and Cofide. Also, he's on the board of directors of Expresso, Valeo, and Pirelli. His European interest is underlined by the fact that he is chairman or vice chairman of the European Round Table of Industrialists and advisor of the New York Stock Exchange. He's also been honored for his services by becoming a Cavaliere del Lavoro, and he's also received the French Legion d'Honneur. This particular topic, capitalism and welfare, of course, is extremely interesting and relevant at the present time. We've all heard so much about the threat to welfare systems by particularly neoliberal economic approaches. As one gets a little older and one tends to acquire a greater interest in one's pension. So I also have a direct personal interest in this particular subject. We are very grateful to you, sir, for joining us this evening and look forward to your lecture.
Thank you very much.
Thank you very much, Professor. Thank you for being here tonight. I will try to tell you a few ideas on the subject which has been described and introduced by Professor Taylor. And of course, I will be glad to answer any question, which is, by the way, the only part which is really amusing for me. So please give me some pleasure, and you ask me any question related to the subject, or if you want, related even to other subjects which are, of course, of great importance and interest to all of us in this very, I'd say, very specific moment of our life. The subject of my lecture is, as it was remembered, capitalism and welfare, what model for Europe? And I will try to be relatively short as I can, even if the two subjects are per se subjects which would require and could require a very profound and long study and not just a short lecture. So please, I ask you to understand that this is just a kind of brainstorming on few basic ideas. 10 years ago, in the state we are in, Will Hutton said he was absolutely convinced that capitalism as practiced in continental Europe was superior to the Anglo-Saxon model. Another quite famous author, Michel Albert, a Frenchman, who wrote a book, Capitalism Contre Capitalism, was convinced that of the two, the Rhenish version is definitely more efficient than the neo-American model. That was Michel Albert's thesis. Then the new economy arrived. There was not a single economist on the face of the world who was not quite sure that the North American system has the edge. Now the cards have been shuffled again, and as always, economists are divided in supporting the superiority of one or the other model. So is this just the latest trend among intellectuals, as Adair Turner, I saw that it was one of the speakers in this kind of session that you are used to have here at LSE, someone who is at home here, asked in an interesting book a few years ago, we should take a skeptical view of the belief that there is a supreme model of capitalism which suits all ages in every respect. That was Turner's conclusion. The fact is that no figure, no conventional measurement can provide a conclusive, unequivocal answer. Every indicator is based on subjective assumptions. How important is available income, use of free time, quality of labor, or how significant is productivity, or environmental quality, or free enterprise. So you can look at it from so many different aspects that it's absolutely impossible to, in my mind, to give an answer to the question whether what is the right system among the one that we know. I think that the plain truth is there is no single foolproof route to economic success. The effectiveness of capitalism models depends on the goal we set out to achieve. I want to take this as my starting point because I hope my remarks will be read as a hesitant contribution from someone who works on the international markets on a daily basis rather than a quick receipt from someone who knows all about the world and the economy. I have been a business for more than 40 years, and I can tell you that, quite frankly, my certainties are few and far from unquestionable. Nevertheless, my experience allows me to make a few observations. Also because, in addition to my business activities, I have been following the problems of the European welfare state for a number of years through activities of the Benedetti Foundation, which I have created in the memory of my father, Rodolfo. So let's move on. We Europeans are the offspring, as much as the Americans, of a culture based on a society built on an original contract among citizens with rights and liberties. But unlike the Americans, we have grafted this culture to a keen awareness of social cohesion and responsibilities for others. As someone pointed out, liberté and fraternité are better mixed together on this side of the Atlantic. If European nations have a melting pot, it is their social institution. The welfare state introduced at the beginning of the 20th century, which would provide a foundation for the balanced growth of our communities over the course of the years. Of course, things are quite different now. The Fordist society that provided the background for the creation of the welfare state no longer exists. Innovation in production are bringing radical changes in the organization of labor. Lack of continuity and uncertainty are now common features of people's working lives. The rise in self-employment means growing numbers of people are taking on the risk of free enterprise. Immigrant workers are employed in an even wider range of jobs. The family is no longer the cornerstone it used to be. People's trust in political parties, trade unions, and state institutions has hit a record low throughout Europe. Everything has changed. Yet there is no reason to believe that the welfare state has run its course. Quite the opposite, in fact. In this climate of change, guarantees, protection against risk and uncertainties, freedom from fear and need are more important than ever. But if Europe wants to continue pursuing these goals, then it will undertake a process of substantial reforms of its social institution, which were created in response to the needs of the 20th century. The European Union, as everybody knows, is not a uniform body. It comprises a variety of social welfare systems, and this is a point I will come back later, some of which operate more efficiently than others. But we cannot go on defending welfare models that are such a financial drain on business that they endanger competitiveness. They are built on the inefficient public systems whose general assumptions about the workplace are becoming rapidly outdated, that fail to take account of the rapid aging of our populations. The issue we are facing today is the following: to adapt Europe's social institutions to the real economy of the present and the future without abandoning their objective and principles, to restructure our welfare systems in order to optimize the resources available and provide an effective and efficient response to today's new insecurities, new risk, and new forms of poverty. This is the challenge, and it needs to be tackled today, not tomorrow. 2003 will be a crucial year for the future of the European Union. The signature of the accession treaty in April will mark the start of the process of European reunification. It will be followed by a series of institutional reforms designed to allow the 25-member European Union to function smoothly. But given the imminent risk of economic stagnation, 2003 must, above all, be the year in which structural reforms are introduced to bring European welfare into line with the risks of the new century and to stimulate new growth. And as an Italian, I would like to think that my country, which takes over the European presidency in 5 months' time, will play a key role. So where do we begin? Obviously, no one has a magic formula, an Aladdin lamp that can be rubbed to produce the roadmap for a new European social capitalism. But we can certainly try and plot a series of guidelines. First of all, the fact that fewer and fewer observers now question the rules of the free market is already a step in the right direction. Correctly regulated, the free market is a phenomenal tool for producing wealth and prosperity. Today, this is generally accepted. The real problem, and we will discuss this in a minute, is how to channel this wealth to ensure social justice and cohesion. Another generally accepted truth is that statism has had its day. Of course, the state can and must continue to play an important role in welfare, but it has to focus on efficiency and get rid of all the washed and bureaucratic red tape of the recent past. Given these two basic assumptions, an area in which important action can be taken already begins to emerge: promotion of private welfare and healthcare services, which allow workers to insure themselves against risk by diversifying their savings. Where the state may fail to keep its promise, private pension funds and, at a more general level, wider access to financial markets can step in. And this would have several important advantages. First of all, it would channel new resources toward business, encouraging production investment and innovation in many European industries that are currently in decline. Second, it would shrink the role of the state and reduce compulsory withholdings on workers and employers. Public resources would be used mainly to support people with no income and provide supplementary coverage for workers forced to cut short their working lives and unable to set aside sufficient pension savings. Third, workers paying into supplementary schemes would enjoy the higher yields offered by the market over the medium-long term, as well as a greater flexibility of the funds. At the same time, this sort of system would pose absolutely no threat to the universalistic vocation of social welfare institutions in many European countries. I fully understand the arguments of people who fear that public health system might turn into second-rate services. But this does not necessarily need to happen. Indeed, it would be advisable for supplementary healthcare funds to negotiate the best facilities on the best terms for their members with service provider. And the more unions and other associations, of which Europe is so wealthy, participate in the ownership of supplementary funds, the more effective this will be. But there is no point in discussing technical solution in any detail, partly because while the general principle, which means moving certain types of social insurance to the market, applies to all European countries, the way it can be done does not. The term European welfare does not refer to just one model. Experts in this area identify at least four different types of welfare system in Europe. Britain's beverage model, the continental Bismarckian system, the generous Scandinavian system, and the somewhat peculiar system of the Mediterranean countries. We don't need to look at the specific feature of each model, but clearly reforms that are appropriate for one country might be far less suitable in another. Conversions of socioeconomic outcomes, such as unemployment rates or poverty levels within Europe, is clearly desirable. But unfortunately, there is often a tendency to associate convergence with harmonization of policies. Lisbon does well to set stringent targets for the European economies, but not to try to standardize policies. Results would differ significantly from one country to another and would tend to increase rather than reduce differences in outcomes. Another important point to consider, and here I do really hope that the forthcoming enlargement will put pressure on the EU to move forward, is a single minimum level of social welfare within the Union, possibly a guaranteed minimum income, a sort of basic right for a European citizen, a floor one should never fall below. It would allow all Europeans to say that extreme poverty does not exist in our countries. Instead of pushing a ridiculous level of standardization, the EU could play a decisive part in social programs. Brussels can act in other ways too. It can help make sure welfare is properly managed in the various countries. It can circulate information on best practices. It can force member states to manage social spending with greater transparency. To a certain extent, we are already moving in that direction. Above all, the Union can promote labor mobility, eliminating the political barriers that continue to impede worker flows among the Union members is perhaps the most important contribution Brussels could make. If European workers were to move more frequently from one country to another, as they do in the USA, employment rate would tend to even out. In addition, pressure would increase on individual countries to improve their welfare system and narrow the gap between social contribution and the services provided. All this would be an enormous stimulus towards greater efficiency in redistribution. And ultimately, the efficiency of the individual welfare system is what matters. A model can be more or less costly. It can provide any number of services, but it has to achieve its goal with the minimum outlay. In this respect, best and worst practices coexist in Europe. In Italy, for example, a huge proportion of social expenditure goes on pensions. This is because over the years, the welfare system has been increasingly used as a sort of social buffer for people at risk of losing their jobs. Nothing could be more inefficient. If Italy has used those resources to create and would have used those resources to create an efficient system of universal unemployment benefits, it would have probably achieved much better results in protecting workers against unemployment while at the same time avoiding dangerous distortion in the economic system. In this area, both Mediterranean and continental European countries have a great deal to learn on the efficiency of the British or Scandinavian system. Here, current programs seem to be achieving much better results than in other countries in combining redistribution targets with the need to contain public spending. I refer particularly to welfare to work. This system implies a double obligation, or if you prefer, a double right. For the state, which commits to provide unemployment benefits and job offers within a reasonable time, and for unemployed persons who must accept suitable job opportunities or lose their benefits. Results are encouraging both in Britain and in Sweden. Long-term unemployment, especially among the youngster, have been brought down with the contribution of these policies. And there is no reason why this system cannot be exported, even through some adjustment would have to be made in countries like Italy. The welfare to work system produces the best results in countries that create a sufficient number of jobs every year. Whereas in Italy and elsewhere in Europe, unemployment is highest in areas where demand for workers is virtually nil. Therefore, a welfare to work policy would have to focus on increasing mobility, for example, by helping to cover the cost of a move or ensuring that information on job vacancies in more advanced areas circulates quickly and reaches workers in high unemployment regions. Moreover, the introduction of a general system of benefits based on the welfare to work model would have zero fiscal impact, or even eventually lead to a reduction in social expenditure. Managed correctly over the midterm, it could boost employment rates and decrease the need for the unemployed to move out of the region. And it would immediately make it much easier to eliminate the widespread practice of early retirement, which is such a burden on the public purse, and allow the welfare system to focus on its specific function of providing insurance for old age. This brings us to the most widely debated issue in Europe today, pension reform. Over the coming decades, Europe will be faced with a sharp acceleration in demographic aging due to three main factors. The baby boomers will reach retirement age, life expectancy will continue to rise, the birth rate has been declining since the 70s. Reform cannot be put off any longer. Pension reform is on the agenda of all the major European governments, and the coverage offered by the European Union can be a significant help here. The project presented by Brussels last December, on the 17th of December last year, is neither weak nor ambiguous. Now it's up to the European Council next spring to adopt a clear political direction. Both the EU, despite all its institutional limits, has already made its view perfectly clear. In 2002, the Barcelona Council decided that the average retirement age should be raised by 5 years. That objective is confirmed today. In addition, a four-point strategy has been outlined to guarantee the financial sustainability of the pension system. First, push a higher level of employment. Second, offer effective incentive for people to continue working. Third, keep the right balance between the working population and the retired population. And fourth, monitor the situation to ensure that public and private system offer effective, accessible, transferable, and secure benefits. All these recommendations are highly commendable. In my view, it is absolutely immoral for the EU governments not to resolve the issue of pensions. It is no longer acceptable for a government to avoid tackling a problem of such crucial importance for the European economy for the fear of alienating voters. On pensions too, the point we made earlier applies. Pension system, like the rest of the welfare system, need to be revised because the world has changed since the welfare state was created. We face other risks today. We have other priorities. And public expenditure has to bear this in mind. What is the priority in Europe today? It is allowing people to retire at 55 or protecting workers from the effects of unemployment. It is defending early retirement or focusing on education and permanent training. It is covering the cost of early retirement or increasing resources for research and universities. If we really want to talk about models, then I would say that the entire model needs to be revised to make Europe a more secure and more dynamic place to live and work. In the old continent, if the old continent wants to show how economic growth and social security can be combined, it needs to shift pension and healthcare coverage to the financial market, reform its social buffers, and raise the retirement age. But it needs other things too. And above all, it needs education and training, research and innovation. Here, we really do have an exciting mission to achieve. It is primarily political, but it necessarily involves business and the unions as well. We have to turn Europe into the land of knowledge. We have to equip the largest number of European citizens to give their best. In a world of mobility and rapid change, we cannot guarantee social security by giving everything to everybody. We have to create conditions that enable people to build their own guarantees on a free, competitive market. This brings to my mind Amartya Sen's capability concept. Capabilities means the potential to do things. I believe that a free society like ours must of course provide basic guarantees, because people who feel insecure about the ABC of their future life are not free. But above all, it should expand people's capabilities, enable them to choose, giving them the strength to enter the market armed with their talents and their intelligence. Part of the population, perhaps still a small part, already knows how to make their way into the market and is not looking for bodyguards but freedom, because they know the way to security goes through freedom. If we can improve education, universities, professional training, this group of people will gradually grow. This in turn will allow to bring greater freedom and flexibility on the labor market, and we all know how much Europe needs flexibility, lighten the burden of anachronistic welfare tools on public account, and introduce greater innovation and intelligence into our business. I am convinced that the top priority for Europe is to provide the best education for its young people, all of them, and those from lower income group first of all. We have to give them education, make sure they have the best teachers, the best school, the best universities. And once they reach employment age, they must not be left to fend for themselves. We have to give them access to an ongoing training so that they can continue to improve their skills. In the States, the professional training centers are packed day and night. This was almost a personal crusade for President Clinton. My American business friends have told me that in a number of occasions they were invited to meetings with the president who asked for their help in improving training and quality of labor. Education and training must be the watchword in Europe too. We need a stronger, more competitive Europe, but Europe's strength and competitiveness depend on the strength and competitiveness of each one of us. This is why government, business, and the unions must join their resources in a huge campaign to make the most of our talents, to release new energy, to reform the welfare system, and give everyone the security they need. The task ahead is enormous. Virtually, to build a new order, new content, new priorities, new objectives. But if we are going to win this challenge, we have to discover our pride. The pride that Europe has displayed so many times in the course of its history. Almost 6 years ago, when Nazism was raging across Europe, a great European, Lucien Febvre, concluded his course on the old continent at the Collège de France with these words: Europe was created when a feeling of European superiority emerged, a feeling of superiority and pride that since then has always accompanied the European at every step, a feeling of superiority and pride that would become one of those great moral forces that increase material forces tenfold. Perhaps this is an exaggeration in the context of this paper, but it would be wonderful if we could make this our new starting point, the pride of being European. Thank you very much.
Well, Mr. Benedetti, De Benedetti has very kindly agreed to answer a few questions, so I'll open it to the floor, a question there. And there are microphones around, so please wait until the microphone arrives.
Please. I'm an old gentleman.
Thank you. I was very interested to hear what you were saying, Mr. Benedetti, about reform of pensions and the sort of project in Europe of raising the retirement age, because I work for an older people's organisation. I work for Age Consent in England. And currently in the UK, we're trying to persuade business here to take seriously the issue of age discrimination, because many people might like to carry on working in later life, but they can't because employers discriminate against them on the basis of their age. And I'd be very interested to hear from you. It'd be very beneficial to hear what arguments you think we should be using with business to persuade them of the case of employing older workers.
Could you translate to me a little bit? I didn't get completely the question.
First of all, I think that it will be, it should be prevented to utilize the system of early retirement. That should be the first precondition. I must tell you very frankly that in my own business experience, I have utilized early retirement schemes to reduce the number of workers when a restructuring of the company was needed. But this is due to the rigidity of our labor system. But it's very wrong. I mean, it's the biggest way to waste money and waste talent, both for company, workers, and state. So, first of all, I think any company should be prohibited to utilize early retirement schemes. There is no reason why what was approved in Lisbon, which is to increase by 5 years the retirement age, should not be generally accepted as a rule, a kind of law in the labor market. And last, I think that there could be incentive created both for companies and for workers to work longer, even, I mean, beyond the 5 years which have been already, from a political standpoint, decided. So I think it's the incentive is always, when you want to create an incentive, you first have to abolish the advantage of doing something wrong, and then try to do something right. The wrong, which has to be eliminated from our concept, our possibility, our way of thinking, is early retirement. And the second is maybe creating incentive for people to stay longer on, and for people and companies to utilize longer the working population, which is a great advantage for the whole society, by the way.
We were talking about best practice and preferences, and I was wondering whether you think that through finding out best practices, it will be possible to find one model for Europe, or whether preferences within Europe are so diverse that it's actually not possible to find one model of welfare state for all the different countries in Europe?
I don't think there would be the I think it would be foolish to think that there can be one model for Europe. I mean, we are a very strange continent, as you know. We are a continent of different nations, different languages, different cultures, and different tradition, even inside our countries, not to mention between our countries. So to create a single system which could be enforceable or adapt to any European country is a dream, but I mean it's a useless dream, because not sometimes the dreams can make you happy, at least when you dream, but this is not even a dream which makes you happy, I mean, because it's an impossible, it's a stupid concept in my mind. So I think that the problem is to, as I tried to mention in my remarks, I think that we have to give the European citizen a kind of floor which is related in a way to the concept itself of being a European citizen, to have a minimum pension level which eliminates the concept of poverty. I think we can afford in Europe, we are a rich continent, we can afford to have a system, I think that in that case, valid for the whole of Europe, by which the level of poverty is forgotten forever, which is, in my mind, would be already a great achievement, something that, for instance, the USA has not been able to achieve. And I think we have the means to do it. Second, I think we should have certain goals. Goals are related to the role that we think Europe can play in the world. I mean, you all know that globalization is something that you can be in favor or you can be against, but absolutely is unavoidable. The problem is how you manage it, but not the fact that you can stop it. So in the context of considering globalization as something which is unavoidable, then you have to ask yourself, what is the role for Europe in a global world? You have to ask it probably for each of the European countries. But let's say that we want to talk about Europe, and let's say Europe as a whole, because you wanted to have a kind of, you were asking a question related to a one welfare system, one pension system for the whole of Europe, and I think I gave you an answer. But I think that we should give an answer to another question, which is, what can be the role of Europe in a globalized world? And I think that if you look at our history, if you look at our mix of population, if you look at the age of our population, if you look at our birth rate, if you look at our resources, natural resources, if you look at our lack of technology, I think that knowledge and know-how, knowledge is our historic background which we can leverage on. It's probably the only one. We cannot hope in a cheap labor market when we compare ourselves to the Philippines or Malaysia or whatever, or China. We cannot compare ourselves with the US in terms of technology because we have lost too many trains. The only thing in which we can hope to emerge is if we leverage on the average level of know-how and intelligence which is in our DNA as Europeans. It might sound very rhetoric, I could agree, but I am absolutely convinced.
Mr. Benedetti, I find your question about eliminating poverty in Europe very fascinating. But how would you measure it and how would you go about? Usually in Europe we consider that poverty is when you have income 50% below the average of the country you live in. If you look at the new countries joining the European Union, most of them are far beyond the 50% of the average European Union as we have it today. So all of these countries would be in the class of poverty. The question to you then would be, on the one hand, would you calculate poverty on a national basis, or would you calculate it on the level of the European Union, which seems to be more in the spirit of attacking poverty for individuals, and the individuals within the Union should really all be the same, or how else would you go about this?
Look, by steps, very simple by steps, because I accept your definition of 50% as level of poverty, but it has to be proportioned or related to the average income of that specific country where you live, because the cost of your life in Hungary or in the Czech Republic is different of the cost of your life in Germany. And when I say by step, is because with a European medium long-term perspective, the average income is going to be, and the average cost of living is going to be more or less the same. It will take probably maybe 10 years, 15 years. I remember when Italy was already, because it's the founding partners of the community, and when the average wages in Italy, or the average income, excuse me, in Italy, were less than 50% of the Germans. That was in the end of the 50s, beginning of the 60s. Now, the average income in Italy is something like 20% less than the German. So I think that when you integrate countries, I'm talking about poverty, I repeat, I think you should measure that compared to the national level, but with a kind of vision and project and wisdom to consider that this is just a step by which uniting countries and markets, you are going to create an average European wealth, which is already the case for France and Germany or for Italy and the Netherlands. I mean, so I think that helped even by the euro, which is something positive, because regardless of what the British thinks about the euro is a very positive element for unifying, has been a very positive element for unifying continental Europe. Now, I know, of course, we can discuss for hours or days, maybe, about for the reasons why the Britons are not, for the time being, in favor of joining the euro, but sooner or later they will, in my mind, because more the economies are going to be integrated, more it is evident that a united currency is needed or is an advantage. So again, I am an Italian, so I normally talk a lot, in proportion to the question. I mean, I should be much more synthetic. But my answer is yes. Compared to the average is to be considered comparing to the national level, but with the vision that in 10, 15, 20 years' time, the average will be the European average and not the national average.
Mr. Benedetti, I was quite interested that you endorsed both the idea of a basic income and the idea of doing more welfare to work as a panacea to solve our problem of social exclusion and unemployment at the same time. Now, as I always understood that this is really an alternative, in the United States, where they introduced the welfare to work system in a big way in 1996, they have explicitly, the Clinton reforms then explicitly abolished the entitlement to transfers when destitute. And in Denmark, where they introduced a Scandinavian type of welfare to work system, it basically is a guarantee to a public job if you are unemployed. So what that tells you on the one hand is that welfare to work means very different things in different systems, as you rightly stressed in your talk, but that it also is an alternative to the guarantee of a basic income that you endorse at the same time. So I would like to you to perhaps to comment on what seems to me to be a contradiction.
There is, of course, you can, I mean, to reach a certain objective, you can, of course, in many cases, you can do it in different ways. In my mind, the most important thing is not the way by which you achieve the goal, but is achieving the goal. And I think that if you want to achieve the goal, you have to take into account the reality of the socio-economic historical situation of the specific country you are talking about. If you want to compare Denmark with the US, you cannot apply to Denmark or to the Danish society the same way of doing, of how you proceed to achieving the same goal, because it would be refused by the Danish population, simply. So I don't think that there is a model which can be, I would say, mechanically transferred from a country which has been able to achieve a certain goal to another country which wants to achieve the same goal. You have to keep in mind the differences, otherwise the difference of socioeconomic difference, the cultural difference, and I would say even the tradition of the country, because you can't achieve goals if not with consensus. I mean, in a democracy, the consensus is not something which is just an optional benefit. It's a precondition to achieve goals is to have consensus. Now, of course, I think that you have to create a political and social consensus being able politically to explain. And here is the difference between great politicians or modest politicians, to try to explain that even if it, that everything has a cost, that nothing is for granted, and that what you are proposing is something that you can prove that is going to be beneficial for your children. But if somebody wants to be in politics, this is the way in which you can be medium long term successful. I don't think you can just try to sell populistic ideas, which, for instance, in my mind, the populistic idea is we take the American model and we just transfer it to Scandinavia. It doesn't work. So, again, I think differentiation and keeping in mind the history and the economic situation of any country, of the specific country, is an essential element to get consensus. And without consensus, you don't achieve any goal.
I was interested in knowing how you would relate fiscal discipline, as we're experiencing now under the Growth and Stability Pact, and welfare state reform. Namely, do you think that austerity is it creating an opportunity for reform, that it creates a structural constraint on social expenditures? Or on the contrary, is it undermining reform, because in the short term, when you reform the welfare state, you want to compensate losers and create institutions, namely you need resources for that?
I am a little bit hesitant to give you an answer because I am frankly about sometimes doubtful about the effectiveness of the Stability and Growth Pact, and therefore to link the two concepts is a little bit difficult in my mind. But anyway, I think I take the Italian example because it's the one I know best. I don't think we have to reduce our welfare expenses as a whole. I personally believe that Italy, as a percentage of our real GDP, which is probably 25-30% higher than our official one. No, it's not a joke. I mean, it's the reality of our country. I think we spend probably less than we should in welfare. The problem is that we address the cost of welfare in the wrong direction. I mean, 90% of our expenses for welfare are dedicated to pension, which is a nonsense. It's not in the interest, it's really not in the interest of anybody. So in my mind, it's not a question of the total expense and therefore the Stability and Growth Pact, but is how you try to address the different issues which are under the big umbrella of welfare among different segments. I personally believe, and I am sure that it's easy to demonstrate, that it would be much more beneficial for the country and therefore for the population, because a country is the population of the country, to have more welfare to work, more unemployment benefit, instead of spending 90% or quasi 90% of our welfare expenses into pension.
There's a question. Yes.
I have a question. Where are you supposed to go first? I have a question. If you live in either Britain or US, a very widespread opinion is that the problem with European economies is that it's because they're so slow and unreformed.
Please.
Can you hear me?
Oh, you should maybe.
Can you hear me now?
If you put the microphone.
Can you hear me now?
Yes.
Is this better?
Yeah, it's better.
One of the widespread opinions in both US and Britain is that the problem with the European economy is that it's so unreformed. And if you only reform financial markets and liberalize labor, you would solve all the problems. What is your opinion, first as a representative of business elites and second as a citizen, to these solutions?
There is no doubt that if we compare the continental Europe or the continental European labor market with the British and even more with the American system, we see a difference which is absolutely unacceptable from a competitiveness point of view. I don't think that the rigidity of labor market is creating jobs. So I think we are, I think it's a little bit of a myth.
It's a political myth, has been a myth of the left in many countries, in France, in Germany, in Italy. The fact that the rigidity of labor is a way by which you protect workers. I don't believe this is correct. I frankly believe that mobility is medium long term a way by which you create more jobs and therefore you protect workers more efficiently. Now, again, I would like to repeat what I told before, and I will be very short. I don't think that you can take the American model and take it to Germany, because it would be refused. It would be refused by the population. But I think that nevertheless, a greater degree of flexibility in the German labor market can be introduced with consensus and is, it would be affect positively both employment and wealth in the country. So I wouldn't take the American model as such and just again mechanically transfer the model to Germany, but I think that we have to increase the flexibility of our working population and our habits, because they are against the creation of new jobs.
I think, well, maybe three more questions. The gentleman there at the start.
Okay. You talked a lot about welfare state restructuring and public expenditure reallocation. And when somebody speaks about public expenditure, I'm always reminded of what Ugo La Malfa used to say in parliamentary debates, that the big question is who pays. So the question is a little bit broad, but I would like to ask you something about what you think, your broad thoughts about taxation, i.e. how you finance public expenditure, perhaps keeping it at the same level that is now, and more specifically about the problem of progressivity, because this is, of course, matters a lot in terms of poverty and inequality and so on. Thank you.
The question who pays is, of course, the citizen, by definition. I mean, in our case, I suppose that you are an Italian as I am, you know very well that for many years we have been playing around with the dream that the debt of the state was not our debt. That has been a long story in Italy. It has gone for more or less 40 years, where people were considering that the state was not their problem, and therefore the debt of the state was not their problem. So this is a foolishness which, luckily, because of Europe, we were forced to forget. About progressivity, I am absolutely in favor of progressivity of taxation. I think that, for instance, I am very much personal. I think that the way by which President Bush is addressing the reduction of the taxes, the plan of further tax reduction in the U.S. is absolutely wrong. It's absolutely wrong because it's socially unacceptable. And if you consider that someone who makes $1 million a year would save with the tax plan which is proposed, for the time being is not yet in the Congress, would save around $80,000 a year of taxes. And someone with an income of $50,000 a year would save $270. You understand that there is something which doesn't work. Regardless of who are your supporters or for whom you are, for whom you think that you are politically working. So I am in favor of progressivity of taxation because I think this is something which is, in my mind,
obvious. I mean, if you have more luck in your life, you have to give back part of your additional luck that God, your family, your DNA, whatever, have given to you to contribute to the society as a whole at a certain level. I don't think that you should kill meritocracy, because without meritocracy you don't have democracy. But you shouldn't kill progressivity, because you create injustice, which long term is going to create an impossible social contest.
Thank you for your lecture, first of all. I listened carefully, and I think you clearly mentioned that there is need to reform both pension market and labor market in Italy. Which one would come first, given that they're both very hefty subjects? And on that note, also, you mentioned the importance of political consensus. How do you think that can be resolved in Italy, given that from recent events it is evident that there is no political consensus on pension and market reform? Thank you.
I would like to answer with a question. Why can you win election with a program which is in the traditional, not in the American term, a liberal program, which is a free market program, win election, have an absolute majority in both the Senate and the Congress, and then not utilize the majority which you won because of your program or what you promised, and say, no, I'm not going to tackle the pension reform problem, not because I don't have the political power in the parliament to have a law passed by the parliament, but because it is unpopular. I frankly don't see how you can justify to win a legitimate majority, which by the way, in our country is the first time in our republican life that that the government has the support of such a large majority, and not utilizing that majority for doing what you have promised to do, just because you consider that now it's unpopular. I mean,
I think we have two more questions. One there.
Mr. Benedetti, good evening. One of the main programmatic objectives of the Hellenic EU presidency for these first 6 months is to close or try to close the digital gap which separates us from the US in terms of the application of technology in productivity. As you may be aware, and I am certain that you are aware, that there have been other initiatives by the European Commission in the past in this field. So since we do have the DNA, what are we missing in terms of policy in this area? Thank you very much.
If I got rightly, your question is, why don't we achieve the goals that we could achieve? Because we are still very much linked to national interest. And, you know, people are elected based on national constituencies. And it's very different, very difficult to intellectually and politically make the jump between your immediate interest with respect to your relationship with your constituency and the medium long-term interest of the country and the continent. This is the difference between great leaders and modest leaders.
great leaders, which we have had the great leaders in Europe, Adenauer, de Gaulle, have been great leaders. And sometimes, or maybe not just sometimes, in many of those cases, like the case of Churchill, for instance, in Britain, after the war, they paid for their courage politically. I mean, as you, even if you are very young, you, of course, you read the history and you know that Churchill, who was a essential element of the victory in the last war, has paid a lot and has been expulsed by the British political system. But the history remembers Churchill as a great man. Now, I am not a politician, so I don't want to teach anybody how to do it. But I think that in judging the gap between today's interest and the interest of your children's is the real. I mean, if you reach the point where you can look at the interest of your children as being more important than the interest of yourself, of your generation, in my mind, this is the measure of a great politician. Now, of course, great is always difficult in any business, including politics.
Final question.
Yeah.
Like that.
Yeah.
Yeah. Okay. In Italy, you are actually well known not only as a successful and socially concerned businessman, but as someone who has also quite a strong opinion on the current Italian government and our prime minister in particular. My question: how do you judge,
in particular, the current European policy of the Italian government, which seems not necessarily to be following the traditionally very pro-integrationist line of the Italian government? Thank you.
It would be easy to give you a very short answer. I don't know what is the European policy of Italy, and therefore I am incapable to give you an answer. And that would be, in reality, my answer. I think that we are our government, on one side, has the consciousness that the Franco-German axe has been the essential element of any step during the 50 years of European history. On the other hand, there is an attraction towards two poles. One is to be original, and the other one is to be friendly to America. Now, I think that we can be friendly to America, which of course I am, keeping our identity. I don't think that you have to be, I mean, I don't think that if you want to be European, you have per se to be anti-American. I am an extremely pro-American, and I am an European. Now, I think that this is probably a problem of, let's say, youth of our government in foreign policy. There is not a lot of experience. And there is normally a tendency of having as prevailing element the show business instead of the foreign policy business. Thank you, Professor.
Could I say on behalf of us all, on behalf of the European Institute and the Ministry of Economics, that we are very grateful to Mr. Benedetti for guiding us so skillfully around an extremely difficult, complex issue with great sensitivity and insight. So I think we're all in our debt to him.
Thank you very much.